Okay, everyone, please take a seat. Thank you. So I'm going to ask Mr. Robertson to introduce item 11. And at this time for item 11, I will close all the speaker cards for that item. So this is last call for a speaker card for this particular item.
Item 11 is approval of a Cambria Community Services District blending of Title 27 surface impoundment wastewater with treated municipal effluent per resolution number R3-2014-0041, the general waiver for specific types of discharges. In July, the board issued a cease and desist order to Cambria CSD, which provided for essentially two options. Close the impoundment or rehabilitate the impoundment such that it complies with permit and regulatory requirements. In compliance with the cease and desist order, Cambria is proposing to close the waste impoundment at its advanced water treatment facility. Cambria will empty the impoundment by combining the contents with wastewater treatment plant effluent being percolated at a location nearby. The combined wastewater sources will not pose a significant threat to water quality. If the board approves this discharge, as staff has recommended, I will issue a subsequent letter approving Cambria CSD's closure plan for the impoundment. Right now, John Rocky of our staff will provide a brief presentation.
Good morning, Chairman Wolf, ladies and gentlemen of the board. My name is John Rocky. I'm a water resources control engineer who happens to be in charge of regulating Cambria Community Services District's Class 2 surface impoundment. This morning, item 11 seeks your concurrence with a proposed discharge that should result in the surface impoundment being emptied and retired from service as a waste receptacle next year. This action stems, as John said, from the cease and desist order you adopted earlier this year. If you recall, the facility flooded in early 2017 and revealed significant design flaws, which led to the cease and desist order. That order gave the district two choices, either rehabilitate or close the facility as a waste receptacle, and the district has chosen to close and repurpose the surface impoundment. This graph shows the reduction in freeboard that resulted from the storm events in early 2017, as well as the effects of evaporation since the inundation ceased. The red line, well, the colors are off, I apologize for that, but the horizontal flat line there, 34.2 inches, represents the amount of freeboard required by the permit. On February 3rd of this year, the facility ceased to be in compliance. So that blue line is kind of an upside down water level, if you will. The vertical axis is the amount of freeboard in the pond. So when the blue line drops below the 34.2 inch line, they were out of compliance. They attained compliance again in June 24th, several months after the precipitation ceased. And at the lowest point of freeboard, they had 23 inches, and that was occurred on February 26th. The proposed disposal method agreed to by both Water Board and Cambria CSD staff consists of blending the diluted impoundment water with municipal effluent from Cambria's wastewater treatment facility and discharging this blended liquid to the percolation ponds adjacent to the emergency water supply facility. This slide illustrates how the process of emptying the pond will work. This will be run as a batch process where liquids will be drawn from the top of the pond's surface and transferred to tanks positioned near the emergency water supply system. So over here on your left, this represents the pond. Water will be transferred to these tanks. Testing will occur once the water is in the tanks for each and every batch. The primary constituent we're going to focus on is boron, because we've determined that if boron levels are sufficiently reduced, all other constituents will also be well be below the regulatory limits. So the district is going to purchase a spectrophotometer, which will be used to test each and every batch. And then once that water is discharged, it'll go follow this line over where it will be blended into the wastewater treatment plant effluent and mixed before going to the percolation ponds. Testing will also occur at the point of discharge to the percolation ponds, and if it's shown that the boron level is not sufficiently low, the valve will be turned, the mixing stopped, and the mixing rate recalculated until we're sure that the levels are sufficiently low. I should state this type of discharge would not be possible if the impoundment's waste had not been greatly diluted by the stormwater during the events earlier this year. This is a plan view of the whole setup. You can see the white buildings here. This is the emergency water supply system. And in the upper left here, this is the surface impoundment. The purple pipe, which now appears blue, runs down here. This originally was the conveyance for the wastewaters from the emergency water supply to the pond itself. The flow in this pipeline, and this is a double pipeline, will be reversed. So water will flow via a new installed pump up here to the tanks, which are supposed to be installed immediately adjacent to the emergency water supply. After the water is tested and a blending ratio calculated, that water will then flow down to the injection point here. This dotted yellow line is the wastewater effluent pipe that comes from the municipal plant. So the water will be blended right here and then discharged into a percolation pond. Staff concluded that the most expeditious and efficient way to permit this discharge is via waiver resolution R3-2014-0041, which requires board approval, and thus this item is before you this morning. So that's it in a nutshell. Staff believes this is the most effective, viable solution for disposing of the impoundment's liquids. It's protective of both water quality and beneficial uses, and it's the best water quality risk management strategy. As John said, he plans to approve of the closure plan following your approval of this item. And staff recommends that you vote to concur with the discharge's tentative enrollment in the waiver resolution. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, and also lights, please. We have four speaker cards, and perhaps we could hear the speakers, and that will help us then perhaps augmenting questions that we may have to answer clarifications. So it'll be 3 minutes each. We have Ms. Heinrich, please.
Hello, thank you. And thank you for that very clear presentation. That was very helpful in understanding exactly what this proposes. As you know, this emergency water project has been expensive and very difficult for Cambria. I appreciate the board stepping in to guide it. Indeed, there is no such thing as waste water. Do we know for certain that the percolation ponds are performing their function? Will there be testing to determine that the boron is not making its way into the stream? Our steelhead and other wildlife depend on the water in those streams, as do the people of Cambria. Keeping our streams and aquifers clean is our highest priority. Thank you for standing guard.
Thank you very much.
If I could just ask all the commenters to state their name fully before they begin. That would be wonderful.
I'm sorry, Christine Heinrichs from Cambria. Shall I go through that again, or? Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, you know, we had a little trouble here with the timer, and just want everyone, my fellow board members, to know that part of my legacy as chair will be that I petition very heavily Mr. Robertson to buy us a new machine that is a little more reflective of state of the industry. So hopefully next meeting you will have actually a display that will show you the time and bring us to the 21st century.
The hamsters are getting old.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And this one has broken buttons. And, you know, we had a previous chair who, sometime had a bit of a temper. So, this is all cracked. So.
Before my time.
Okay. So, thank you. So, next speaker card is Mr. Key.
Good morning, board. I'm so impressed with your commitment and awareness as to all the varieties of pollution sources that are affecting our world and our central coast. I can tell that you really care, and it's a tough job. The idea to include desal waste in our regular waste stream is a bad one. It's just about financial problems that are plaguing Cambria as a result of this hobbled plant and how it's brought our financial situation to its knees. All your charts and all this so on is very interesting, but here's the bottom line in a word problem. If I have 100 pounds of boron and I mix it with 1,000 pounds of water and I put it in point A, or if I have 100 pounds of boron and I mix it with 10,000 pounds or 10,000 gallons of water and put it in point A, I've still put this stuff in the same place. It's just common sense. The question is, where does all this stop? The CCSD's motive these days seems to be give them an inch and take a mile. Please don't set precedents here for this dumping today. I'll just relate a quick story here. I was walking down by the ocean the other day and I ran into just a regular guy like me. He's wearing his Raiders shirt and we talked about football and he came up to do a little fishing and I said, well, you live in Cambria. He says, oh, no. I says, I had 100 miles to come up to Cambria to fish. I said, really? I says, how come? He says, well, water down where I am is gray, brown, full of bacteria, and the fish aren't very good. But up in Cambria, the water is clear and clean, and the fish are good. You get what you preserve. Dilution is not a solution to pollution. Please deny this resolution. Thank you. I'm sorry if I didn't state my name. My name is Ted Key, and I'm a resident of Cambria.
And a Raiders fan, right?
Actually, I'm a Green Bay fan.
All right. Thank you very much. Next speaker will be Leslie Richards.
Leslie Richards, 30-year resident of Cambria. Thank you for letting me speak here today. I'm a rancher. This is not my forte, and I'm scared to death whenever I come to this podium, so I'll do my best here. Sorry. So I'm going to touch on what I adore regional water control staff. I think they're fantastic. I think they do a fantastic job. And if they were the one who was actually doing the monitoring program on this, I would have no problems with this at all. The fact that the CCSD has shown over the last 3 years that their monitoring of their plant and their processes is quite lacking is what I am concerned about. And we are relying on the coyote to watch the hen house on this issue. Boron is very dangerous to the ecosystem in this sensitive Escher habitat area. In August of 2015, I was contacted by a journalist at the New Times who stated that the CCSD was looking to modify a current NPDES permit at that time because of the original failure of the impoundment. They were trying to convince the regional board to possibly allow them to do this blending in August of 2015. I was in a panic, and I contacted Ryan Lodge, and he stated emphatically that it would not be allowed because the chemicals in that impoundment were so dangerous. This is my ultimate nightmare right now happening. I was reassured over and over again that this was not going to happen, that these chemicals were not going to be released, either 10 gallons or 100 gallons per minute, into ESHA and a sensitive habitat. It's one thing to go down to South Sand and to dump this into a deep water wedge 2 miles off the coast. It is a whole other thing to have this dropped into one of the most sensitive blue flag steelhead rookeries in the state of California. And by the way, I brought to your attention at the podium at the meeting in Watsonville, there is other contaminants in this water, and there are chemicals of concern, contaminants of emergency concern. And you actually, I have here a copy of your actual original permitting deposition where a number of the original directors that are not here on the board right now brought up this monitoring of these contaminants of concern. And they said, well, yeah, we can add that to the permitting process. You like, and it was completely blown over on the NPDES permit. So you've already discussed this originally 4 years ago on the permitting process. The reason I bring up this document as well is because Mr. Lodge actually was questioned about this particular issue in the original permitting process, which is in this document. I'd like to read that to you today. Board Chair asks, Board Chair, I'll start on my right, Mr. Jordan. Jordan, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lodge, maybe you're the right guy finally to ask this question. So is the evaporation brine an actual health issue as it drifts away, or is it just an annoyance? May I finish reading this, sir? It's very fast. I'll finish it. Mr. Jordan, so whether it's an annoyance or a health hazard, it will stay there in the impoundment area. Mr. Lodge, response, correct. If there is evidence that shows it does not stay within the impoundment, they will have to recalibrate and shut the blowers down. And Mr. Jordan, if it was to leave the impoundment, is it a health issue or annoyance? Mr. Lodge, we didn't look at that because it should not leave the impoundment. So I have to challenge the no risk to the environment section of you. I think we are a little premature on this decision. Is it no risk to the environment?
Okay.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you very much for your comment. Next speaker card, and I had two late speaker cards. As a reminder, you know, I closed the speaker cards at the beginning of the item, so you know I don't end up having trickle amounts. But in a good faith effort here of getting full participation, I will allow the last two speaker cards in the presentation. So having said that, I will ask Mr. Tim Carmel to come for your 3 minutes.
Chair Wolf, members of the board, my name is Tim Carmel. I serve as district counsel to Cambria Community Services District. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank district staff, particularly John Rocky, for collaborating with Cambria staff in developing this plan. It was largely his work and his idea. And he worked diligently, and it's greatly appreciated. And I wanted to just make sure that you were aware of that and he's aware of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next 3 minutes is Amanda Rice. Thank you.
Chair Wolf, board, as president of the Cambria CSD, I just want to echo the thoughts of Mr. Carmel. Your staff has been more than helpful in getting us through this process for closure, and we really appreciate all of the support that's been provided by all of the staff, from Chris Adair, John Rocky, Taya, from Harvey Packard, from all of your staff, and it's very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. And the last speaker card will be Tina Dickinson, please.
Good morning, Chair Wolf and colleagues. I'm not here to mince words this morning. This is the third time I've appeared before your board regarding this project. In 2014, I urged this board or previous members of the board to not issue either Title 22 or 27. This project was a rush to judgment, as it has clearly been seen and witnessed from all of us who've paid attention. The permits were issued. It was unfortunate. Your agency has been dealing with a district that has not followed the rules. They have not met the requirements necessary to remain in compliance with your agency, resulting in numerous NOVs. My question to you this morning is this. In the closure plan identified by the district and in negotiation with your staff and with Mr. Rocky this morning, and now before you for approval, what action or actions will be taken by you, the regulatory agency overseeing the closure plan, if the district does not adhere to the terms set forth by your staff? We have seen time after time after time where they have not adhered to the requirements and the regulations. The CCSD has been treated with a great deal of leniency, in my opinion, on the part of the regional board, giving the district numerous warnings on late reports, reducing an almost $600,000 fine to $53,000. I do not feel Mr. Rocky's report this morning gave us enough information. First of all, what is the boron level quite right now in that surface impoundment? And what is the required amount? I think it's 0.75 milligrams per liter. That was not mentioned in the report. Those things need to be up for the public and for you. That was not sufficient information. I do not think that you should go ahead with this resolution today. There are real issues. Those percolation ponds sit close to San Simeon Creek. It's in an ESHA area. The district has recently spent thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars on a swale 10 feet wide, about several feet deep. I've taken photos and I sent them to Mr. Rocky and to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and Coastal Commission. They are not happy about it. There's a giant swale on the north side facing San Simeon Creek Road. The county has put in asphalt berms with a 14-inch pipe going down to Nary on the west. There's a great big swale on the east. So instead of taking the contents out of the pond, which is what should have been done, and they claimed they couldn't afford it, they spent a ton of money on getting these giant swales 10 feet wide, several feet deep. And Mr. Rocky has the photos, 26 photos I've sent, of this disgusting mess in our habitat. And you're talking today, all of you, about the environment. I applaud you for that. But this is environmental injustice at its worst. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. At this time, if you can enhance some clarifications on the questions, and then my colleagues, can ask further questions as well.
Sure. So, I'll take these in order. Ms. Heinrich's comment about is there going to be testing in the stream? We're not planning on testing in the stream. We're planning on testing at the point of discharge to make sure that it complies with the basin plan's agricultural limit of 0.75 milligrams per liter. And I did a fairly extensive literature research on the effects of boron and the appropriate levels. And everything that I could read says that 0.75 will be protective of both marine life and plant life and human health. So now on to Mr. Key's comments that we're only doing this because of the district's financial situation. We had several meetings with CCSD staff following the issuance of the cease and desist order, and finances is definitely an issue. Trucking the brine strictly out to Kettleman is over $1 million, and the district doesn't have those kind of resources, financial resources, to do that. So we came up with a number of potential ways to treat this water and then dispose of it. We looked at putting it through the existing facility there, but unfortunately that system is not designed to remove boron and wouldn't achieve the result that we needed. We looked at doing ion exchange, which is also prohibitively expensive. And finally, we came up with this solution, which is really a risk management strategy designed to get that water out of there as soon as possible and close that pond. It's our thought that the longer the waste sit in that pond, the longer the risk exists, and we want it closed and the permit rescinded. His comment, Mr. Key's comment about pollution is not the solution was drilled into me in engineering school. That's a sort of a truism in environmental work. But in this case, the reality is that when you dilute the concentrations with rainwater, as this impoundment currently is, and then you further dilute it with the effluent coming from the municipal plant, all the levels will drop to below regulatory limits. There is a possible exception regarding TDS and sodium. Those concentrations in the wastewater effluent vary according to time of year. So in the wintertime, they seem to be really high every year. We think that's from the high occupancy rate of all the hotels and all the room cleaning and stuff that goes on there, possibly with some infiltration that goes on to the collection system. But on average, there will be a very minuscule increase in TDS and sodium. All the other constituents will be well below regulatory levels. Ms. Richards commented about the monitoring competence for the district. In the closure plan, we specified that this spectrophotometer must be operated by trained staff only. And I intend to be out there initially when they start up and at various points during this project to make sure that the sampling is being done properly. This will be done on site with a fairly high-tech device so we can get near real-time results and they can adjust the flow ratios accordingly. But you know, the district has the ability to make sure that staff are properly trained in this instrument, properly calibrated periodically, so that we're sure of what's actually going into the pond. Regarding the CCSD's request to blend back in 2015, I don't really have any knowledge of that. But I'm sure that Ryan Lodge was talking about the blending of just this raw waste in the pond, not this highly diluted wastewater that we're currently talking about. Ms. Richards also talked about the risk, and she didn't want any risk at all in the environmentally sensitive habitat area there. Unfortunately, there's always risk associated with wastewater discharge. The district discharges each and every day, 24 hours a day, into the percolation ponds in that habitat there. And there have been impacts that we've observed in the past to the San Simeon Lagoon. And to the district's credit, they've addressed the nitrogen issue in their municipal discharge, and we've seen dramatic decreases in nutrient levels in the lagoon. So it's really been a success story there.
Right, and that just to play on that, that success story is actually in the EO report in this agenda package.
So then I appreciate Mr. Carmel's and Ms. Rice's thank yous for the work. We've staff, not just me, but collaboratively, a lot of water board staff have been participating in these meetings and coming up with this solution. So it's been really a group effort. Ms. Dickinson points out that the CCSD has had numerous violations, and that's undisputable. They have. Most of them, thankfully, have just been reporting violations, not impacts to water quality per se, but getting the reports in on time and having them accurate and correct. Her question about what happens if the district fails to follow this plan, I would have to defer to our enforcement group. I think if they fail to follow this plan and took a U-turn for some reason, we would pursue them with enforcement action, and we have a number of regulatory arrows in our quiver that we could do that with. So what exactly we would do, I can't say, but we wouldn't be idle. The required boron level, as I stated, is 0.75 milligrams per liter. That's in our basin plan, the agricultural regulatory limit for boron. And then finally, Ms. Dickinson mentioned the big swale that was installed on the north side of the surface impoundment. And that's really a stormwater mitigation measure that the district has done basically at our request in the cease and desist order. The board stated that if this project continues into the rainy season, which we are hopefully approaching very soon, that they still need to be in compliance with the Title 27 aspects of their permit that they're currently covered by. So they did a hydrologic study of how much water would be coming across the road in a 1,000-year storm and in a 100-year storm. They did a geologic survey. They bored six test holes adjacent to the surface impoundment to get a real good look at the geology underneath the pond and try to figure out what they could do about keeping the water level from rising to within 5 feet, as is required by Title 27. And then they dug this big swale, which is intended to divert, I think it's like 400 cubic feet a second of water in the event that the atmospheric river heads their way again. So they've spent quite a bit of money and quite a bit of effort to address the flooding concerns, as well as put together this closure plan, which would have them out of the pond and the pond closed before the end of 2018 or the commencement of the rainy season in 2018. So we think this represents the best solution, the most timely solution, and the best way to mitigate the risk from that impoundment water.
So if I could just augment your comment a little bit, Ms. Shiraki. I participated in some of the meetings with the Cambria CSD. I did not, and maybe this is a testament to John's compassion, I did not look at the CSD's ability to pay as a factor. I was looking at it from a water quality risk management strategy, what affects the quickest risk reduction to water quality. And this pathway was the one that presented versus, say, an evaporation, you know, continuing to use a pond and some sort of evaporation strategy or something like that, which would extend the life of the pond a number of years. These are soft numbers, but the anticipated duration of this strategy gets them out of the pond maybe sometime in the summer, 2018. Understanding there's a lot of variables in this in this estimate.
Their closure plan calls for them to run this batch process 7 days a week, more or less 24 hours a day, and that would result in them being out of the pond with average precipitation around July of 2018. Now the weather is really the big variable. There's a number of variables that go into the blending ratio and all that, which would are all taken into account, but if it rains very hard and we get a lot more water in the pond, that schedule will slip.
And correspondingly, the concentration of boron would likely go down in the pond too. So the blend rate may go up. So there's variables at play constantly here.
So at this time, I will start on my left, then move to my right. So, Mayor Delgado?
Yeah, one question Ms. Dickinson had, I think it's answered, but I didn't hear John answer it. She asked, what's the boron level now, and what will it be? And you mentioned that it'll be below 0.75, just barely. Is it true that it's at 5 milliliters now?
The concentration varies. Yeah, the boron concentration varies with depth, depending on where you sample in the pond right now. The latest number I had was from a composite sample that took into account various depths, and that concentration was about 5.5 milligrams per liter. So, but that's not the current surface concentration, which is where we draw the water from. That's a composite throughout the different depths.
And it gets more concentrated as you go down?
That's correct.
Okay. Can you explain the freeboard is and why not 7 feet or 4 feet? Why is it 5 feet requirement for freeboard space?
Sure. There's really two issues with Title 27 and that the cease and desist order addressed. The 5 foot that you mentioned is the separation between the top of the groundwater level and the bottom of the liner in the impoundment. And that's meant as a factor of safety so that if a leak occurs, you have some reaction time before that water hits the groundwater. The freeboard issue has to do with the distance between the top of the pond where the water would overflow and the water level. So that distance is called the freeboard level. So the permit originally required 2 foot of freeboard plus the ability to contain a 1,000-year storm event, which was another 10.2 inches. So the permit originally required a total of 34.2 inches of freeboard. And that was the number that was violated on that graph I showed you with the lines. So really there are two different measurements. The 5 foot has to do with the distance to groundwater. Freeboard level is the distance from overtopping the impoundment and releasing that waste into the environment.
Okay, so the freeboard is to prevent flooding outside the pond. And what's the other one called?
It's a five foot separation.
Yeah.
Separation is what it's called.
Separation, right.
And that's from the bottom of the liner or the bottom of the pond and where the groundwater level is below the surface of the ground.
Highest anticipated groundwater level. So bottom of the system and the highest anticipated groundwater level, that has to be 5 feet or greater.
Okay, so in wetter years, the groundwater comes higher and closer, and in drier years, it drops, is that correct?
Yes.
And so in wetter years, you don't expect the groundwater to get closer to the bottom of the pond than 5 feet.
That's correct.
Okay. Is this a time for questions only or comments also?
Both.
Okay, briefly on the comments, I think everyone in this room pretty much respects the staff, and I heard the speakers just now, most of them respected the staff, and it was clear to me through reading the report and talking to staff over the telephone that staff has done a lot of work and staff believes in what the proposal is here. And the findings on page 2 of 22 of the resolution that we're considering adopting says the listed discharges will not have significant effects on water quality provided that there is compliance by the discharger. And elsewhere in the staff report, it says that the dilution of the effluent down to less than the 0.75 milligrams per liter of boron will preclude any threat to the environment. So I think that if we respect staff and their time and effort on this to try to find an affordable solution that will work, I think it's okay today to respect the conclusion that staff is asking us to approve. So I'm supportive of what staff is doing. Thank you.
Mr. Young?
Thank you. I think Ms. Dickinson also, I think, raised the point that she hadn't seen the 0.75 number being displayed. Okay, all right. Okay, it is in the staff report though. Okay, and we had been briefed, the board had been briefed before the board meeting on some of these items. That one was briefed in detail and we're all aware of that number. And we, right, but it is in the written material, okay, and it is in there, the regulatory number is 0.75 milligrams per liter. That's the action level. Question I have for you is, in your review of the literature, at what level is boron becomes problematic? Did you see any studies that suggest at a certain level there has been a determination that life becomes impacted?
Yeah. The toxicity literature that I reviewed regarding sensitive species, the number was, I believe, above one. And for plant life, it depends on what plant you're talking about, but the protective number in the literature was also 0.75, which I took, I concluded was where that number came from in our basin plan as well.
So is boron, you mentioned it in terms of toxicity, so it's just like a pesticide or any other substance that would affect, would have a lethal effect?
Well, when they do toxicity studies, they do these different criteria, the LC50, et cetera, mm-hmm. Where 50% survivability after X number of hours exposure, all that sort of stuff is as risk management. So it's toxic in that sense that they do toxicity studies and they do see some effect in the newborn species of whatever species they're looking at in the study. But in terms of toxicity, as we would normally think of it as being, if you would discharge this into the lagoon, would fish turn belly up? No, they wouldn't. This is well below that level. And as I said, the literature really shows that the most sensitive living thing are really plants when it comes to boron. Aquatic species are much more tolerant, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. Thank you, John. And I appreciate the comments from the community. That's always important to hear from direct experience. And I know all of you have been paying attention to this situation, which reflects a number of problems that derived from the drought and some other solutions that often have unintended consequences. My question, I have a couple questions. One, the basic question, what is the source of the boron?
The boron, I believe, comes from cleaning solutions they use in the emergency water supply plant. They have a number of cleaning agents they use. They have a pickling solution they use to keep the membranes from going bad while it's being mothballed as it currently is. So primarily that's it. It's from cleaning solutions, from trying to keep all the pipes clean and all the various apparatus lubricated, if you will, so that they can start this thing up again in a year or whenever they choose to start it up again and it'll work properly.
Oh, I see. Okay. And then maybe you can clarify for me. It's just not clear. Table 2, which appears on page 5, shows the wastewater treatment plant effluent quality, and the footnote there mentions that the effluent for boron or other Title 27 constituents are not required monitoring. But I think I heard you say that when the pond... materials go through treatment and are blended with the wastewater effluent, they will be monitored at the point of discharge.
That's
so,
correct.
So while the wastewater treatment system isn't currently treating or reflecting any levels of boron, which do we know? Would a wastewater treatment plant also have that same problem with boron as a cleaning solution being used within the system?
I have seen some boron levels for the wastewater treatment plant effluent, even though it's not a required constituent. But they tend to be approximately the same level as we see in the groundwater there.
Okay. So just background.
Right, just okay. Background. That's uh-huh. Like 0.3, 0.4 milligrams per liter.
And it's
in that
pretty low.
Quarter.
Okay. So by monitoring at the point of discharge, we're really tracking the pond removal of the pond water?
Well, we're tracking the combination of both the effluent, wastewater effluent, and the pond water combined.
Okay.
So that 0.75 will be both of those things added together.
Okay. All right. That clarifies. Thank you.
Ms. Gray?
Thank you. Thank you, staff. Thank you to CSD, and thank you to the community members who have come out, and I appreciate your dedication to this issue throughout the years. I have a couple of questions. What was the frequency of the sampling for the boron, the frequency of the sampling?
For this project, when they start, it will be every batch. So every time they refill the tanks, it'll be tested anew, and then that discharge blended with the wastewater effluent will also be tested. So every time there's a new batch, there'll be at least two testing events.
Okay. And are there any alternatives to boron as a cleaning solution? Is there any other effective way of?
That I can't say for certain.
Has anybody explored that?
Jerry Gruber, the general manager for the Cambria Community Services District. So there's two processes to preserve the membranes for this facility. One is to pickle it, as John referenced, and keep those membranes in place. And then there's another alternative, which is to have a professional firm come and remove those membranes and take them and house them in an appropriate solution off-site. That is the best way to address the boron issue from happening again. Right now, we're in the process of we're pickling those for cost reasons. But in the future, I think it's a good idea for us to not have to bear that burden for a whole bunch of different reasons, and just to have them professionally sent out and maintained at an off-site facility in the appropriate solution. And then when it comes time to reinstall those, we do it that way. So we've learned through this process that because of staff time, because of the probability of boron getting into that pond, even though we're going to close it, the most appropriate thing to do would be to preserve those things off-site, those membranes.
And so how far into the future is that in your operational plan to do that?
Well, we're pickling them right now. We could do that at any time. We could decide at an administrative level or a staff level to do that, which I don't have a problem with at all. We've been working so diligently with Regional Water Quality Control Board staff, but for us to do that, it would just be a matter of contacting the appropriate representative and moving forward with that and doing that until we decide to start that again, that facility.
So sounds like a good option. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then as it relates to the TDS and sodium, I mean, I know that these are sort of temporally based, dependent on who's occupying the community at the time, but they're not required to monitor those, or they are? Or do we have any mitigating factors for those?
They monitor those quarterly at the wastewater treatment plant. So that's where we get the data for those. Mm-hmm. I can see the variations over the year.
Okay. But we don't have any way of mitigating those?
Well, typically the low-hanging fruit for a community is to do an ordinance that prevents water softener discharges from elevating the TDS. The discharges we see in Cambria aren't really from full-time residents. Water softeners.
Right, it's from
thus
the
all the
transient
variation.
Occupancy.
Right.
Correct.
So the solution, unfortunately, for removing salt is very expensive. It's basically a reverse osmosis.
Right.
It's a huge undertaking for a community of this size.
Thank you.
From a long-term perspective, staff feels that a lot of the chloride issues, or TDS issues, are related to INI, which is infiltration and intrusion. As Mr. Rocky indicated, when the wet weather comes and those groundwaters, if you will, that are historically high in TDS are allowed to infiltrate the collection system, then our TDS into the plant and out of the plant goes up. So the solution to that would be to continuously address those INI issues, especially during the wet weather times, to reduce those levels of chloride coming into the plant, thus reducing them leaving out of the back of the plant.
So it sounds like you have learned a lot of things, and hopefully you can put some of these lessons learned into practice. That would obviously be
yes, ma'am.
My suggestion. Thank you. Appreciate it. I have no more further questions.
Mr. Johnson?
Thank you. First of all, on the boron, I'm a little confused about a couple of things. First of all, I see on page 5 of the report, tables 3 and 4 talk about, table 4 talks about the background level of boron, the groundwater monitoring, which looks like it was between 0.21 and 0.32. And then table 3 talks about a round of testing that was done at our request in October of this year of the effluent data, which was 0.4. So if the sewage treatment plant isn't adding anything to the boron levels, why is it higher coming out of the plant than coming out of the groundwater?
That's a very fair question. I interpreted those results that 0.4 is very close to 0.32, as we see in that well 16D1. And all of these sampling events seem to be very dependent upon time, when it's sampled and how it's sampled. So the various constituents in a wastewater treatment plant, effluent, will vary almost any time you take them. But it's in a range. Okay. So I wouldn't say from this one sampling event that the boron coming out of the plant is always 0.4 or greater. It just happened to be at this time.
So to the point that 10 pounds of boron in 100 gallons is in some ways the same as 10 pounds of boron in 10,000 gallons. Well, how does boron, so what we're talking about doing is restricting the level of boron to 0.7, milligrams per liter?
0.75.
0.75, rather, or parts per million, same thing, I guess. In the effluent that is being percolated, correct?
Correct.
And now, is boron sticky? Does it just basically, how does it travel through the soil?
You know, I haven't looked at that closely. I can't say for sure.
So, I mean, I know nothing of geology. If it travels like a salt through the soil, you know, if you put that 10 pounds in over a long period of time, it'll have a chance to flush. If it accumulates, it doesn't. So we don't know we don't know.
I would say that the worst case scenario is that it's not sticky, that it flows through the aquifer, goes into the lagoon, and eventually into the ocean. Mm-hmm. That is 100% transfer. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the assumption I made when I was doing the literature review, that all that would make its way into the lagoon. And I tried to assess the sensitivity of different aquatic species. Now, the other scenario where it's sticky and it stays in the soil...
is less bad.
Is less bad.
Okay, I get it. Now, I remember we heard about this during the cease and desist order discussion, and I frankly don't remember what I heard then. What's the plan for future operation for the brine from the emergency water treatment system if they don't have the pond?
Well, we haven't been presented with a formal plan yet, but sort of the general theory is they're going to install some tanks, Baker tanks or whatever kind of tanks, and then periodically truck it either to South County for putting in their brine line or to another appropriately regulated facility.
So to be completely clear, if they were to, if the CCSD were to start running that emergency plant again next month because it doesn't rain, without storing every bit of brine and backwash that comes out of it, then they would be in immediate and complete violation because they won't have the permit for the pond. Is that correct, if this passes?
That's correct. The cease and desist order ordered them to cease discharging waste into that facility. So that's no longer an option for them.
Okay, so until there is a work plan and presumably an approval of a modification of this order by this board, that plant's not going to operate. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, or not without real consequences. Okay. Now, I see in here that our plan is that it's going to be drained down by July of next year to the dregs, basically, assuming rainfall, et cetera. And I guess as you get down, I presume that as you get closer to the bottom, what comes out will be more concentrated, and that will kind of slow the drawdown rate. Do we have something in here that designates the point at which they stop drawing out and start trucking out?
We don't have a sort of a trigger number that would say you can blend up to this number but not beyond. At some point, it becomes extremely inefficient because the ratio of blending this pond water with the wastewater plant effluent is so low that there's no point in continuing, really. You know, we estimate, and the closure plan contemplates somewhere around 20 gallons of pond water for every 370 gallons, I believe, of wastewater treatment plant effluent. And that's sort of the average rate that the whole closure plan is premised on. But you're correct. At some point, it's going to be the dregs, as you call it, or there's going to be a fair amount of solids in the bottom. In their closure plan, they say they contemplate that would be somewhere between 1 and 2 feet of the bottom material, and that material would be vacuumed out and trucked off to a disposal facility.
Well, let me be blunt about my concern here that this question goes to. I'm sure that the process of vacuuming it out and trucking it to, I presume, Kettleman City is going to be an expensive proposition. And I see in what we're considering here today, we're considering something that somewhere less than a year from now will have the pond drawn down to the level where that can happen. And then we're saying we expect a work plan that says that the rest of the stuff will be hauled out within 5 years. So if our concern is to get this thing closed as soon as possible, if I'm imputing the worst motives to the district and begging your forgiveness, if I'm interested in pushing back that expense as far as possible, I'm going to just keep on kind of dribbling the water from the pond into these tanks and blending to put off as long as possible having to write that check to vacuum stuff up and move it, and we've got that stuff sitting out there for something up to 5 years.
So there's a couple things that mitigate against that strategy that I'm going to assume that the district is also aware of. First of all, they have to pay a bond for potential discharges associated with that facility, and that runs about, I'm going to say, about $70,000 to $75,000 a year. That, stretching out the lifespan, that comes year over year. So that would make not disposing of that remaining, I think you use the word dregs, not cost sensible, you know, if you stretched it out over a period of years. They also have to burden up the monitoring costs associated with that too. So they have to go out and monitor the wells on a certain frequency, do the analysis, submit reports to us, the manpower cost or woman power cost on that too.
What wells are they monitoring?
There's wells associated with the pond itself. Okay. So as long as you got waste in the pond, you're running the pond. And you have to oblige the monitoring associated with that. And so there's costs that work against keeping that thing open too. And I think those start to make disposal look more attractive.
taking the dregs out. To staff is, if we anticipate that this pond is going to be down to the level that they can start vacuuming it out sometime next year, and if our interest is, as clean water regulators, to get this thing closed down at the, in the earliest possible timeline, why are we saying we want it emptied within 5 years? That there's a disconnect there for me.
Well, forgive me, but I believe it was the board that put this 5-year timeline on it.
Oh.
And secondly, I believe that the closure plan they submitted includes the time it takes to vacuum out this remaining waste and truck it off. So that timeline of getting it emptied, hopefully before the next rainy season in 2018, includes that vacuuming and disposal, us coming out and certifying that all the waste have been properly removed and disposed of, and then saying it's okay to close this facility.
I think the original proposal was evaporation, and that was some ridiculously protracted timeline. So I think at our meeting, we wanted something more manageable, and that was that 5-year. That's my recollection. I could be incorrect there. But, I think it's in our interest to have this closed as soon as possible. And so certainly we're going to be getting updates on this, correct? And so if there's an economic incentive for the district to close this as soon as possible, I think that that would be in their overall best interest and the interest of the community. So that's just my thought.
Would it be appropriate to give some direction as far as what we would like the executive officer to see in an approvable work plan in terms of starting that process of trucking that stuff out? I realize we're working with ranges here, and that they depending on rainfall, they might be done in June, they might be done in October, but I don't think that they're like unlimited ranges.
You're correct.
Yeah, I think that's fair game for the board to give direction with respect to, let's say, limiting and planning for when the trucking should happen versus this sort of indefinite, it'll happen kind of approach.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the direction I would like to see, and I realize that direction is a consensus of the board, not just my opinion, is something that both gives our staff the ability to say, okay, this is, you're reaching the practical level on the dilution and percolation process, and it's time to start trucking, and our staff some, and clearly we would want that trucking to go expeditiously. And I'm not quite sure how to formulate that, but let me see if I have any other questions. I think that's it.
All right, thank you. regarding the boron toxicity, as you pointed out, there's two environmental aspects. One is aquatic habitat, and the other one is plants. The aquatic habitat, the nearby sensitive aquatic habitat is the salmonid, and there's quite a bit of a difference between boron sensitivity to the adult steelhead versus the fingerlings, and tends to be, significantly lower of a threshold. In regard to the plant material, you're correct, it depends on the plant materials, but permanent plants, such as trees, or such as if we look at farming, olive trees, avocados, wine grapes, you have a cumulative effect to the plant tissue. So there is a big difference between having, seasonal exposure versus cumulative exposure. And then that level, you know, that these values do change significantly, and you know, they are available through the USDA website. So I just want to mention that. But what I'd like to do is to have you get the slide that shows the map with the location of the pond and percolation site, etc. Okay, here we go. So I think Tim Cleef had done an evaluation of what the high water mark would be. And if my memory serves me right, you know, if we had high storm events, it was getting close to 5 feet. Am I mistaken on that? Because that was trying to determine, you know, what was happening, if it was seepage water or if it was groundwater level rising within that 5 foot space.
Yes, his study concluded, and it was sort of stating the obvious in my mind, he stated that in periods of prolonged rain events and when the creek levels rise, that the water table would rise to within less than 5 feet of
right.
separation.
Okay, so where I'm getting at is, you know, you have a monitoring point, which is the discharge point to the percolation pond. However, there is close proximity to, you know, the blue water stream adjacent to it. So it would be reasonable to view that when you would have a high storm events, you could have migration of that percolation pond water to the adjacent blue line stream. And then you correct me on my assumptions. So where I'm getting at is that we could have water of a lower quality compared to ambient water quality of a blue line stream. And that would seem to me to be an issue of anti-degradation, because you're not supposed to discharge in blue line stream any water that is an exceedance to the its existing ambient water quality. So tell me where I'm perhaps wrong in this, or what I'm getting at very simply is that if we did have monitoring in addition to the discharge pond monitoring at the creek itself, you know, certainly we would validate, okay, we don't have any infiltration taking place.
We do have, the district does have two monitoring wells that I believe are down here in this corner, that well 16D1 and MW4. So there is some downgrade of monitoring that will occur ongoingly.
Yeah, but that's quite a bit of a distance from, you know, if we look at the distance from the blue line stream there,
yeah.
Particularly on the bend,
yeah.
I mean, you're looking at a very short distance.
Right. So two things occur to me. The first is, and the thing that really allowed me to be sort of accepting of this approach is that this is a temporary situation. We're not talking about a discharge that's going to go on for years and years. Hopefully it'll be far under a year and this thing will be done and closed up. And the second thing is that because of the location of these perk ponds, these things have been influencing the lagoon since they started being used. They're hydrologically connected. Maybe not 100% of the year, but I think usually they are. We could see the effects of the nitrogen discharges from the municipal plant in the lagoon at almost any time during the year. So you're correct. They will have some impact.
Okay.
But again, I want to emphasize this is a temporary situation. We're not at all advocating that this would be a long-term solution to the district disposing of their brine in this way. This is only because this impoundment was so diluted that we're even contemplating doing this.
Okay, so to address, you know, what some of my colleagues mentioned, and particularly Mr. Johnson, you know, we had given a five-year period, now we're talking about something shorter, so I do think we need to memorialize that and not just walk out with a handshake over it. So that's point one. Point two, if there is a relatively cost-effective solution of instead of doing on-site pickling of the membranes to take them off-site, you know, because if, let's say, next year you remove, you no longer use the pond, you can discontinue your performance bond, which translates into a $70,000 to $80,000 saving that probably more than offsets the cost of taking your membranes offsite. So I would say that should be a second action step. And also, if you know there was willingness here from the district, perhaps we can memorialize that too, since you know they volunteered it. And I would say let's make that an action step. So, yes, go ahead.
Well, I would say that once the pond is closed, whether they choose to pickle these membranes or not will not impact any discharges mm-hmm. to the environment. They'll no longer be moving boron into the pond. They'll be trucking mm-hmm. it offsite. So that's purely, a financial consideration for them as to what's most efficient for them to do. But from the water quality standpoint, this pond will be closed, and those wastes will not be headed toward the environment here.
Okay, so then last set of questions, if you can go back to the very first slide, which was 2017 floods. You had a picture, here we go, thank you. So we had issues of the culvert overflowing, you know, on the county, I guess that's county road, right? So how has that been addressed today?
The county has done a fair amount of grading work on the right side of the road. If you look at that upper left picture there, mm-hmm. they basically have sort of cut a swale to the invert to that culvert up there, which appeared to be uphill, if you remember back to the cease and desist order. So I've gone out there and looked at that, and they graded it in such a way that there has to be a fairly substantial depth of water already crossing the road before it'll ever get to that culvert. That could be improved. They did some grading on the left-hand side of the road as well that will work for, you know, small rain events. And then they put a drain up by where that white car is, more or less up there. There's a little curb up there, and they put a drain sort of in the middle of this curb and a pipe headed down toward the drainage from the culvert. And then there's also talk about perhaps raising this roadway level here so they don't have this dip. And that's an ongoing conversation, I believe, between the district and the county about doing that to prevent some of this.
Okay. So then the other issue, and I want to go through those because, you know, I think this is an opportunity to see, okay, where are we today? Aside of focusing strictly on the boron in the pond, et cetera. There was issues of the fencing that was not properly maintained, and there was breach of a fence. So what is done today to prevent that?
Well, the trees have been trimmed back from the fence line and the fence line repaired. They did find a break in that fence that for whatever reason was there, and deer found a way to scooting through this little break, but that's all been repaired.
Okay. Then the other item, which my understanding is still an issue, is that the ground squirrels and the gophers, quote unquote, made and are still making Swiss cheese out of the embankment. And that's not a technical term, but I think you get the picture. I can do better than that.
I think I'm responsible for that Swiss cheese analogy. My understanding is the ground squirrels are no longer an issue, but the gophers still are. The district has told me they've changed their exterminator contractor out there. Apparently, the previous one was, you know, they gas these burrows and try to fill them with gas, and you know, they kill some of them that are down in there, and you don't know whether they're dead or not. Some flee and then come back once the gas is gone. The new contractor apparently is putting a substance in the gas that lingers in these burrows and dissuades the gophers from coming back. But You're correct. When you go out there and you walk the site and you look at some locations, there are a huge amount of burrow holes. And I'm concerned about that just from a structural integrity standpoint.
Right, and because I recall, you know, working with Mr. Robertson's predecessor, you know, that was actually looking at some type of subsurface barriers to prevent gopher and ground squirrel entries, which could damage the lining.
Right. So originally, the original design called for a gopher fence mm-hmm. all the way around. Unfortunately, when that was installed, it wasn't really coming up to the proper height. So they could, you know, it was maybe in places like foot and a half above the ground surface, and they could just kind of go right over it. They recognized that deficiency in the gopher fence, and they came back and raised it. Now it's approximately 3.5 or maybe 4 feet tall. And I believe that is now keeping the gophers out, new gophers, but the ones that are in there are still a problem.
Okay. All right. So thank you for these clarifications. In summary, the 2017 flooding events, there's been corrective actions taken. And then last questions about the past, the history, is that there was a chronic issue of reports, delays in report, incomplete reports. Are we 100% up to compliance with all reports today?
Yes, they are. I believe that since February of this year, they have not had a late report.
Okay, that's very encouraging. Thank you. So to kind of then bring this item to conclusion, I heard some suggestions in terms of looking at, you know, the instead of a, you know, 5-year kind of limiting a little bit more this time frame. I think that was the key suggestion. I'm listening
there
to
were,
my colleagues.
There were two
here.
Elements to what I was suggesting. One was to have an acceptable work plan include the ability of the staff to say, okay, enough pumping, time to start vacuuming. And the second was to have a staff look for something in the work plan that had an acceptable pace on the vacuuming and clearing. I think everybody agrees, including the district, that they want to get this thing done.
And I'm going to recommend that not necessarily be a number, but something like a narrative, like as fast as is reasonably possible, and that judgment would be by the regional board staff.
I have no trouble with the staff. I think it's pretty clear what we're talking about.
Right.
And there are some ranges here and some levels of unpredictability depending on rainfall. So.
Yeah, so that way we don't become overly prescriptive. You know, and kind of causing ourselves to perhaps, you know, if let us say that 2018 we have significant rainfall, if we get too restrictive, you know, it would be out of compliance. So what I'd like to do is now you heard our input, both of you, is, you know, saying, okay, maybe this is what could be worked out, and then just to make sure that we're all in harmony, you know, having the district likewise say, yep, we're very comfortable with that. That way we all agree on agreeing today. And then we move forward and we have a successful completion of this project. So any word of wisdoms?
Well, if I am interpreting Mr. Johnson's concerns correctly, he's concerned, one, that the pumping, the blending rate will get so low that it just drags the timeline out too far. And then two, there's a potential for a lag between when the blending stops and the trucking starts. So we could say something like, you know, there will be no pause in removal of materials from the pond once blending stops. That would address that pause issue, maybe.
I think those components are going to be in the work plan that you guys are going to approve, correct?
Are they currently?
They're not. I don't believe they are currently.
Is there a work plan? I'm trying to remember. Is there a work plan in here?
I don't believe you all have seen the work plan yet.
Okay. No, the closure plan is not included with the.
Okay, and is the work plan approved at this point?
No.
Okay.
Because it's dependent on today.
Yeah, I think you guys understand what we're talking about in terms of the work plan, and I'm fine with you incorporating that.
Okay.
I don't think we need to change what we're voting on here.
Well, what we can do is to memorialize, giving direction to staff that this be included in the work plan. Yeah. Jessica?
So what I can say, I can recommend one way to do it that's the simplest, is that final closure of the pond will occur as quickly as reasonably possible. And that will include both pumping and then the trucking elements. So everything will happen.
Right. Staff will incorporate that in the work plan.
And I'm looking at the district.
Jerry Gruber, General Manager for the Cambria Community Services District. Yes, that's acceptable to us. Absolutely. Staff's been wonderful to work with. We want to continue to build confidence and trust and a good working relationship with you. You've been more than fair.
All right. Thank you very much. So at this time, we need to put this to a vote, and I don't see any further comments. So do we have a motion?
Move to approve.
I'll second.
Second. Any further comments?
Yeah, just for discussion. I just want to say thank you to the citizens who have come up and spoke. It's not easy to show up, and it's not easy to speak. It's not easy to advocate for something, especially if it's not what's already in the works. If you're trying to make a change, that's harder than just saying, we agree. So I just want to say that I appreciate your time, and I hope that we've done some to hear you and try to make some changes to reduce your concerns. But we're doing the best we can, and I'm thankful that you're here today.
No, Ms., because the proper protocol is speaker cards, and we gave you the opportunity because then it would be unfair for other parties not to be able to comment, and so that's the proper protocol and the fair procedure for everyone, and also proper transparency of the process. I'd like to, further support Mayor Delgado's comment, though, is that I think you saw that we took your questions, everyone's questions or comments, to heart, because this became specific parts of some of our questions we asked staff to respond. So we have exercised due diligence. I think also the outcome is a better outcome after all these, close to 90-minute hearing we had, because we came up with a shorter time frame. We addressed also clarifications toward the end of the process and the vacuuming. We addressed also questions associated with toxicity. I think we've done our due diligence here. So at this time, we have a motion, we have a second. Do we have any further comment from my colleagues?
I just have one comment that I don't think I have to urge the residents who were here speaking in opposition to keep an eye on how this goes and to communicate with our staff if you see anything that doesn't smell right. I don't think I have to urge you to do that, because your presence here today tells me you're going to, but that's important, because we have a limited staff, and
that's
we
an understatement.
Do what we can do. Thank you.
All right, so at this time, if we have no further comments, I would like to request a roll call.
Dr. Wolf?
Yes.
Dr. Hunter?
Yes.
Ms. Cervantes? Mr. Delgado?
Yes.
Ms. Gray?
Yes.
Mr. Johnston?
Approve.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate everyone's participation and contributions, member of the public, and the district representatives. At this time, we will take a recess of 1 hour, and let's round this up of to reconvene at 1:30.
Any closed session?
No. Thank you.